So you were speaking about helping the escape attempt of a German general and some sort of jacket.
So I put under the pretension of anti-Soviet propaganda and damaging or stealing Soviet property, I was condemned to 25 years in Siberia. And that happened in 1948-49 in January. I was not even there when the court convened. I got only the message, that's it.
Once you were back in Germany?
No. As I was still there. And then I made my way out.
Well, before we get into that, I'd like to get back into the power structure. What was your position within the camp? Did you have any key role to play?
No.
No.
Very a prisoner of war. Mm-hmm. And of course, those who were not pro-Soviet Union, they got the worst treatment of all.
So, who was the highest ranking? Who was the highest ranking officer in your camp?
A colonel.
Okay. And what was his? But did he give the orders to the camp or?
No.
No. Not at all.
The Russian named one officer who had declared publicly that he would go on the Russian side, so to see.
And what was his rank before?
It was a major.
It was a major. All right. So that was very above. So another thing inside the camp I'm interested in is the, I've heard of schools, is this correct, where you band together with a group of other captured and you share provisions in order to sustain each other?
Mm. The food is, of course, one of the most important points for a prisoner, since a normal man would need at least about 1,000 calories per day to survive. We got less than 500, which is not enough to live. So the fight for food was quite strong. And since the Soviet Union itself had not enough food for their own people, it was the order that every food was distributed absolutely correctly. For example, there is a room with 50 people or 100 people. So they get bread for 100 people. But the bread you have to divide then yourself, or somebody, and divide it. And you can imagine that 90 pair of eyes are on that everything is correct. So, but most of the time we didn't even get the official ration of Russians, which we should get, because there was bribery and was used by the Russians, they had not enough to eat themselves. So that is why we were starving.
What did you do? Was it at all possible to supplement your...
How?
Food? I'm assuming, was there other sources, possibly a black market or...
Yeah. Black market with whom? You are in a camp with big barbed wires around. Nothing there. You have no clue how miserable that is.
Mr. Peter is now showing photographs of, is this the camp?
This is where we are marching to arrive in the camp. Here we are in the camp and coming back from work. Here we are marching again somewhere else.
What work did you do in the camp?
What kind of works? The first year, I was totally unable to work at all. I was paralyzed, couldn't walk, couldn't use my left arm, so I didn't do much. this is a so-called meeting here. Here we are waiting. These are only snapshots. Mm. I tell you the story of these photos later. But this is how a life of a prisoner looks like in the Soviet. These are stuff.
Would you mind telling me how these were taken just now as we look at them so we can get them?
Yeah, there was one officer, a German officer, who was from the police, and he had one of these minute little photos, photo apparatus, with what you can make. And he made all these photos.
How did you come to be in possession of them?
Yeah, and after his films were used up, he sold the photo apparatus away. But the Russians had heard something and they fished it out of the Borneo, but they never got the man. So what we did then, we had one man who had lost a leg, and one of our doctors had made him a wooden leg, and we hauled out that leg and put these films in the leg, and this amputated man was sent home in 1946, and brought the films home. So these are the result. That is our camp. One of the camps. I was in 14 different camps.
Mm-hmm. Did every member, well not every member, but how many people got copies of these?
Four or five. Look how bad nourished you're looking. And that is the work we are doing.
You're plowing there or carrying
carrying wood out of the wood. That is all frozen. There's the Kama River near Yelabuwe on the Kama River. There's an old monastery in which we were. Here we come with the wood in the camp. That is the way. And this is one of those who had changed to the other side. He looks well nourished. This is us.
Well, better clothed as well.
Minus 40 degrees. Assembly. Every morning the dead corpses will be carried out with that. And then they carry the bread with that in.
Back in. How many would go in a night?
Different. But when you were punished by the Russians, who came into Karza, they called it. That is, the water was knee deep in the room, so then you could sit only on a table, and you look like that. And this is awful.
Is this the photographer photographing himself?
No. And this is, look at these figures.
Skeletal.
Oh, skeletons, of course. And this is the famous railway bridge north of Kazan from the Trans-Siberian Railway. This is a big picture of a plywood factory. I have to order them again. That again is the monastery in Yelabuga on the Kama River where we were. And that is the second. Here's the Russian officer of the day, and the German, who was promoted from the Russians to be the responsible officer, gives report.
So they're saluting in this picture.
That was a hospital.
Okay. with this, obviously saluting in that picture. How formal was it in the camp? Were you required to salute these people set up by the Russians?
No, not at all. He despised them, of course.
So you would not get in trouble for open aggression against them?
No. You read my book, and most of these questions are answered.
Okay. All right. Well then.
If you come back the next time, I hope you have read the book. Only 88 pages.
Well, one purpose of this interview is also to get this on tape. Much of the information in the book on tape as well.
Sometimes it's difficult after, what is it now, nearly 65 years is exactly 57 years ago.
So you got 149 more. Well, just for the tape, can you describe the daily routine of the camp, say, and what would you do? When would you wake up? How would you work?
Okay, in the morning, of course, the wake up was when the first, those who were due to bring in the food came with the bread. And then everyone was wide awake. So, thereafter, all those who could go work, to work went to work. Had to go to work. Those who couldn't, like me, because I was most of the time, still there the first years because of my wounds, and later on because I was simply too much. I was 88 pounds, and I'm 6 feet tall. So, there's a very easy method to examine people whether they can still work or not. Can you imagine once a month there was the order that we all came stark naked out, lined up. There was a doctor and a nurse sitting. The doctor was a female doctor and the nurse, and we had to walk by them. The robot did the pinch you in the behind. And if between their fingers is more than only skin, then you still can work. That's the whole examination. So, very, very easy.
Yeah.
But when there was nothing anymore, then it's the last part of your body where you, when that is lost, there's nothing anymore.
So how quickly would it take a prisoner to reach that state?
I lost about 50% of my total weight within the first 3 months. Became a prisoner on the 3rd of June. And then the first 2 weeks I was treated very well thanks to a Russian doctor who was a student of my father, had been a student of my father. But thereafter then I came to Moscow and then it was quite a different story and I lost that weight. So after 3 months I was practically so well dead. As I came finally in a camp, there was a doctor from the prisoners, one doctor, an Italian, and his helpers, the nurses, were also Italian men. And I was brought in and they looked at me and said in Italian to his brothers, "That poor guy will die tonight." And I understood that since I had learned Latin and Greek. So I said to him, "No, he will not die." As you see, he didn't die, but it was close enough. And later on, a few weeks later, I was literally dead and I was in the morgue already. A Russian doctor picked me up. You will read it in my book. And so somehow it so worked.
What do you attribute your survival to? How do you think you did it?
Stamina, well training to be strict against yourself, self-discipline, luck, belief in God, and the strong will not to give in. And I think somebody held a hand over me. Otherwise, I wouldn't have survived this.
This is just fascinating stuff. When you were released in, how did the release, like, this is something I don't understand. How did they keep you for so long after the war was over?
Oh, my God. It's a very easy equation. That millions of Germans, I was the cheapest labor you could get. And the Russians said, "Oh, you have to rebuild what you have destroyed in Russia." And so they kept us as long as they could. It was only 1955. Some of my friends stayed up there up to 1955. And one friend of mine in particular, he was shot down, pilot. He was shot down in 1941 in August. And he came back in 1955, 14 years. And at home, he had a 15-year-old daughter. Who had never seen her father.
So even though you were too thin and even though you couldn't work, they still kept you there?
Well, of course. Because I was on the other side. I was not on the Russian side. So the Russians always said, oh, if you don't work with us, you will never come home. And I probably would have never come home because I was, as I said, tried for 25 years in Siberia. And if I would have transported there, I would have never survived there. There's no doubt about it.
So, even though it may be in your book, can you describe how you did get home?
This is so complicated, reading the book. It was a very long story. The combination of good luck, of using the moment, you will read it. It's a long story. I think it is better described there as if I try today after 57 years after it.
Well, it looks like I have to read this book. So
that was the reason. I came home in May 1949, and I met my now wife, and we wanted to marry, and we married yesterday, 2 days ago. Was our wedding anniversary.
How long? 57 years.
And she complained that for the first 3 years of our marriage, I was doing nothing of that, talking about this time as a prisoner of war in Russia. And then I was flying already again for Swiss Air in 1952 or 1953. One day I fell sick and had to stay home. I was in bed and I started handwriting down my memories. Because it was burned into me. And then after several days or so, I was all right again, started flying again. I forgot about writing. And I said, oh, I can always continue that. I will never forget it. But as life goes, you forget things. And time passed by, responsibilities, family, God knows what else was going on. And finally, as I was in Canada and I retired from my last job, and we moved out in the country. We were in a nice estate. As we were moving, these pages fell into my hands, which I had handwritten. I started reading them and said, that sounds not too bad. And I sat down and typed it in my machine, and my son got hold of it. So it made a little booklet out of it. He made a little booklet out of it. This is in German, of course.
That's right.
Where all that what I had written up to then was in it. And he made about 100 copies. And I sent these to my friends in Germany with whom I was a prisoner of war in the Soviet Union. And the reaction of that was so that they pressed me, you have to continue to write on and so. And finally, that was in, he already in Victoria. Finally, I wrote the rest. And so, which is that what you will read then. But of course, that was now already 50 years after the happenings. So I just painted in great strokes to bring it to an end, because this year is abruptly comes to an end in the middle of an action. We were just singing, and that stops, and I should have continued that then, which I didn't do. So I did then many, many years, decades later, I was sent by the German I was at the time senior official in the German government, Ministry of Transport, and they sent me to the International Civil Aviation Organization, which is located in Montreal. This is a specialized agency of the United Nations responsible for international civil aviation, and I was a senior official there until chief of a section, personalized in training practices, which deals with one of the most important parts of aviation, the human beings.
Okay.
And after my retirement, after I reached my retirement age, I stayed in Canada. That was all. So my family was here. We all fell in love with Canada. So I stayed here. We are now 34 years in Canada.
Just going back a little bit, I'm interested in when you got home, how you adapted back to life in Germany and with food. And
as I came back, I was told, you were the ones who made the war, you were criminals. Because that was what the Allied propaganda had taught the Germans in the so-called re-education. So we were the losers, and that was end of story. Nothing. I had to work, and I didn't want to starve, so roll your things up and work. That's what I did.
I just can't imagine coming from nothing to the, well, I don't have much of an idea of post-war Germany, but there was plenty of food. I mean, what was that like?
No,
psychology?
Not plenty of food.
Lots more than in the camps.
Was not plenty of food. Was starvation also there, very badly. But meanwhile, it was 1949. The war stopped 1945. Mm-hmm. And that was 1949. And I had the good luck to meet my now wife. And she was taking care of me the best way. My mother also. And her mother, the families kept together and helped, but that was all.
How did you meet her? Did you know her before the war?
Hmm?
How did you meet your wife? Did you know her before the war?
I knew her before the war. She was young. Her older sister was my friend as I was in confirmation lessons for the church for confirmation. So then I was, and she was, we were 14 years of age. We knew one another, that was all. And she was a younger sister, who at that time was 10 years old. Nothing.
All right, well, I think I need to read this book. I don't know if I have any more questions for you. How is there anything you feel you need to express to say on this tape, as it's going to be a historical document? About your time in the camps.
I would say if you would have read my book first, then your questions would be different.
Yeah.
And then, but one thing I can say, it doesn't matter from which country you're a prisoner of war, and it is only the way the problems are mainly the same. Whether you are a Canadian being a prisoner in Japan or in Germany or ever anything else, it is basically the same. The problem is always the survival, hunger, number one. In the Soviet Union, of course, freezing, I froze my feet and everything. So, freezing, lack of food, and fear. And that is a big question. How do you handle your own fear? You can go and submit yourself to the victory power and say, okay, I will do anything you want me to do as long as you feed me. Or you can say, I am what I am, and according to international rules, Geneva Convention, you have to handle me the way I am. I'm an officer, and that is my status. And as long as I'm in, you are responsible. As long as I'm a prisoner of war, you are responsible for keeping me alive and according to that status. And when I came home, then I can make free decisions. As a prisoner of war, I'm unable to make any free decision. But only the majority was not prepared to follow that path, because that could mean, particularly in the Soviet Union, death. And that nearly meant it for me too, but I was one of the luckies who survived in that. So that is what I can say. If you don't have anything to believe in, you can call it God or Allah or what else. It doesn't matter, but you have to have something you believe in, something which is above you, that can give you strength. And without that, I've seen people like trees so strong who died like nothing. And I've seen people who you would expect to die within the next 2 days, they survived everything. The mind over matter is the word. So never give up.
All right, well, thank you so much. This has helped me immensely. And I will take this.
You want to come back?
Well, I mean, I have to see.
I have not brought you much.